This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents In the Unlikely Event, written by L.J. Shin, performed by Joe Arden, Shane East, Muffy Newtown, and Savannah Peachwood.
1. Present day. Rory. My life is contained in a round, beautiful snow globe. The kind no one has bothered to pick up from the dusty shelf in years. Unshaken, quiet, and still. From the outside, my manicured Swiss village looks perfect. And it is. Kind of. At 26, it appears I have my life together. Perfect job, perfect apartment, perfect roommate, perfect boyfriend, perfect lies. Well, they're not lies, per se. All my accomplishments are real. I worked hard for them. Problem is, I promised 8 years ago to give them all away in the blink of an eye if I bumped into him again. But back then, I wasn't the same person I am today. I was lost, grieving, broken, confused. Not that it matters, because that was then and this is now. And it's not him I'm staring at. Nope. There's no way. It's not. Then why can't I tear my eyes from the mysterious stranger who glides through the doors of the Birchman Hotel's ballroom, turning every head along the way? Ruddy cheeks tarnished by the unforgiving winter, an aristocratic square jaw, Roman nose, and lips made for the darkest sins and most sordid pleasures, all framed by tousled, coal-black hair curling at the ears like ivy, rumpled in 1,000 different directions. His slanted, brooding eyes, broad shoulders, and narrow hips make him more than handsome. He's perfect. Too perfect. As with all cruel fairy tale princes, I long to spot something that would indicate his immortality, a lack of humanity, something that would prove his perfection truly is impossible. Pointy ears, long fangs, a little tail. Come on, God, give me something to work with here. Anything. He is tall, but not enough to demand any special attention. No, Malachi Doherty doesn't need imperial height, fancy clothes, or millions in the bank to justify the awe he triggers in people. His existence alone is enough to make women fall to their knees. I saw it then. I see it now. All eyes at the ball are on this enigmatic man, mine included. Stop it, Rory. It's not him. If only I could see his eyes. Then I'd be able to put this to rest, to know for sure. No one else has those eyes. A rare shade of violet, like crushed crystal candy.
Lack of melanin mixed with light, reflecting off red blood vessels,
Mal explained the night he took my innocence, heart, and panties all in the same breath. I watch as the man strides past security and into the VIP area without missing a step, ignoring the curious glances and lip-biting female admirers. Even celebrities throw themselves at him, chasing his lazy stride, trying to strike up a conversation as the large bald bouncer unhooks the red velvet rope separating the mortals from the deities. The man who cannot be Mal ambles toward the bar, his eyes zeroed in on something. Or rather, someone. Record label tycoon Jeff Reiner, who has up-and-coming R&B darling Alice Christensen, known on stage as Alicious, sprawled in his lap. Jeff's 40-something face is hued pink by excessive drinking and cocaine. As the man approaches, Reiner stands, letting Alicious slip from his lap, her ass hitting the floor with a thump. Stepping over her body, he rushes to Mystery Man, falls to his knees theatrically, and plucks a large stack of cash from his breast pocket. to wave in the stranger's face. The man who is not Mal lets loose a cold smirk, plucks the money from Reiner's sausage-like fingers, and slips it into his coat pocket, saying something that makes Reiner stand up in a rush. Well, that puts a lid on things. Mal would die before making a deal with a bigwig like my boss, set himself on fire before attending a glamorous gala, drink cyanide straight from the bottle before associating himself with the likes of Jeff Reiner. Mal is not cold or arrogant or high-browed. He cuts his own hair and high-fives strangers and thinks brown sauce is the cure for all of the world's problems. Mal hates lavish events, entertainment journals, mainstream record labels, and elegant food. He loves his mammy, having the crake, getting shit-faced, and songwriting while lying under the flawless night sky in his backyard. He refused a check for $16,000 a pop sweetheart tried to give him to buy one of his songs, simply because he had a good laugh watching her confused manager and agent try to decipher the word no. But that was 8 years ago, a little voice inside me points out, for a period of 24 hours. What do I know about today's Malachi Doherty? What did I ever know about him at all?
There she is.
Callum's arms wrap around my waist. I jump in surprise, his posh English accent startling me for a second.
The belle of the ball.
His lips, still cold from the outside, brush my ear from behind. You made it. I turn around, wrapping my arms around his neck and giving him a peck on the lips, like punching a time card. He's still wearing his pale gray suit from the office.
Don't I always?
He scrunches his nose. He does. Callum is the most precise, trustworthy man I've ever dated. The exact opposite of spacey, unreliable Mal. When I look again, I see that my boyfriend has remembered to wear my favorite tie, dark green with strings of gold. When we spotted it in the store about 2 weeks into our relationship, I told him it reminded me of Ireland, and he immediately bought it. I yank the Nikon D18 he bought me for my birthday from my purse and snap a picture of him, capturing his rich boy, pouty smile as he searches my face for approval. I've been freelancing as a photographer for Blue Hill Records ever since I got my arts degree 4 years ago. It pays next to nothing, but next to nothing is still better than actual nothing, which is what I got paid when I interned here for the first 3 years. I work a part-time job as a bartender to pay my astronomical Manhattan rent. It's not that I have to live the poor Manhattan girl cliche. I have an inheritance from my late father, but I refuse to touch it. Using it never even crossed my mind. I'd burn the money if I could, but that would give my mom a heart attack, and I don't want that on my conscience. I never wanted the money. I only ever wanted my dad in my life.
You look gorgeous, love.
Callum captures my chin with the back of his thumb, tilting my head up. Do I, though? I'm the opposite of what a man like Callum would usually go for. I have pale, borderline sickly skin, big green eyes always framed by an industrial amount of eyeliner, a nose hoop, and an undying love for everything punk rock, which is probably getting a little old at my ripe age of soon to be 27. Right now, my red gold roots are showing at the top of my long silver ombre hair.
Like strawberries in the snow, Callum says when my roots are showing.
I'm wearing a messy ponytail, and I have on a striped red and white dress, which I paired with Toms and a studded choker. Put simply, I could pass as a Victorian ghost who got lost at Spencer's. Sometimes I suspect that's what drew Callum to me in the first place. That eccentric, vibrant shell that could elevate his status more than any plastic trophy wife could. Look how open-minded and hip Callum is, with his hipster, artistic, holds on to an actual job girlfriend. Her breasts are unenhanced, and she is not on a first-name basis with the saleswomen at Neiman Marcus. I look like something from the cast of Beetlejuice. I laugh, kissing his neck. His low rumble vibrates against my body. Callum removes a lock of my hair that has escaped my hair tie with the back of his palm and presses his lips to the flesh he just exposed at the base of my neck. I like Beetlejuice. He's never watched it. He told me so on our first date, but correcting him seems redundant and like I'm trying to find non-existent issues in our relationship.
You know who else I like?
He dips his head down for another kiss. You, in that Tiffany's necklace I bought you. Yeah. The one he gave me, along with a sensible dress. Because I'm cool, but not always cool enough to look the way I do next to his friends. Careful. I'm turning 27 in a couple months. You might give me ideas, I tease. The words feel empty on my tongue, but I know how much pleasure he takes in hearing this.
My father told me not to threaten a whore with a dick. Do you know what that means, Aurora Bell Jenkins?
That's my tall, stockbroker, Wolf of Wall Street boyfriend, with his Eton and Oxford education, with his impeccable manners and dirty mouth. The man whose only fault is being exactly what my mother wished for me. Rich, powerful, well-bred, stable, sweet, boring. What Mom doesn't know is I like Callum despite all of those things, not because of them. It took me 6 months to relent to his persuasion because I knew she'd like him, and the things my mother likes are usually artificial and shallow. He'd been chasing me around for months. Finally, he showed up at the bar located beneath his apartment, coincidentally the one I work at, and slammed his palm against the counter.
Tell me what it'd take to make you mine,
he slurred that night. Stop looking put together and on the sanity spectrum, I deadpanned. You remind me of everything my mother wants, and my mother wants all the wrong things.
Is that why you keep saying no?
He frowned, confused.
I come here every night, begging for a chance. And you turn me down because your mother could like me, God forbid?
I shrugged, reaching for another steaming hot glass, wiping off the condensation.
I'm a clusterfuck, love. I failed my first year at Oxford, miserably, and not for lack of trying.
I arched an eyebrow, giving him a really smile. I needed more to work with. Callum blew out air, shaking his arms like he was getting ready for a marathon.
All right, let's see. I have a birthmark the size of my fist on my ass. I still eat Lucky Charms for breakfast, every single day. My personal trainer says I have the arms of Rhys Ifans, also known as Hugh Grant's roommate in Notting Hill. I can't swim.
He threw his arms up in the air, triumphed, as everyone around us lifted their heads from their drinks and smiled. I chuckled, shaking my head. Maybe he was imperfect, but he was far from the kind of mess I was usually attracted to. Debbie, aka Mom, had always complained that I only went for the last of the litter, the broken, misunderstood, messed up ones. Who couldn't offer me more than a heartache and STDs. It wasn't untrue. I didn't look at men very much, but when I did, they always came with more issues than Vogue. Callum had leaned forward then, his entire torso plastered on the counter, and framed his mouth with his hands, pretending to whisper in my ear.
Can I tell you a secret?
I have a feeling you will anyway.
I think you were put on this earth to destroy me.
I laughed, taking a step back. The conversation with Mal from all those years ago floated to the front of my mind, reminding me I'd heard those words before. Things Mal and I said to each other always lurked in the recesses of my thoughts. Mal had told me I could kill him. He didn't know that, in a way, he'd killed me, too. Every day I lived without him, slugged by like a snail, leaving a trail of slimy goo in its wake. "Okay, fella, time I call you a cab," I tapped the back of Callum's hand. That was before I knew he owned the penthouse upstairs. "I'm serious," he pouted again. He knew he was attractive, knew his angles, the charm in his accent, how to work a girl into giving him her number. Unfortunately, I was immune. Putting another clean glass aside, I threw the cloth over my shoulder.
"Can I tell you another secret?"
He dragged his thumb across his lips. That's when I noticed his lips were ridiculously kissable, even without the pout. "Do you always ask for permission before you say things?" I cocked my head. He laughed.
"Usually, believe it or not, I'm the one people ask permission from. Anyway, I'm not even drunk. This beer, it's the only pint you've served me tonight, and it's full. I don't come here to get pissed, Aurora. I come here because of you."
I paused, my eyes glued to his pint. He was telling the truth. I knew because I served him every night. It occurred to me that he was the exact opposite of Mal. The fancy clothes, the properness, the sobriety. Maybe he was what I needed to rid my mind of lingering thoughts of the Irish poet. Which meant Callum was also the exact opposite of my father. Which meant for the sake of my sanity, I should at least give him a chance. He was my redo, my second chance, my redemption.
"So, would you give me one date?" he begged. "I promise to prove to be wonderfully unstable with a dash of incompetence and provide you with plenty of unpredictability."
"Fine," I rolled my eyes with a giddy smile. "Ha!" he slapped the bar in triumph.
"It was the unstable bit that did it, wasn't it?"
He settled himself back down, pushing his beer away like he finally could, like it revolted him.
"Always gets the ladies," he said.
I take a deep breath, meeting Callum's eyes in the ballroom. "I'm sure you're about to tell me all about the whores and the dicks," I say, his erection throbbing between my legs through his cigar pants and my dress. For the record, Callum lied that night at the bar. Not one bone in his entire body is messy, risky, or uncalculated. As for the birthmark, his skin is as unmarred as a blank new sheet of paper. Callum Brooks is attractive in a Nantucket summer house, 2.5 children, polo shirts and golf tournaments kind of way, with his pulled up white socks, sandy blonde hair, impressive height, and runner's body. Summer, my best friend, likes to joke that he looks like David Duke's dream candidate. He looks into my eyes.
"I'm a serial monogamist, 32, and have been dating you for almost a year. Commitment doesn't scare me, Rory. If I have it my way, you'll move in with me tomorrow morning."
I unbutton his blazer and loosen his tie, just to do something with my hands. I like Callum too, but a year is still early in our relationship. "It took you 24 hours to promise Mal your forever," says the voice in my head. I was also new to dick and non-self-induced orgasms. I proceed to make excuses for my 18-year-old self. Callum ushers me to our table. We sit down next to a bunch of suits from accounting and marketing who munch on their first course ceviche and talk about hedge funds and newly popular beach towns that are driving people out of the Hamptons. Callum slides into the conversation effortlessly, sticking to his club soda. As he does, still without a drop of alcohol. I focus on my colleagues, trying to put the man in the VIP area behind me. As I said before, it's not Mal. And okay, fine. Let's humor the craziest part of my brain and say that it is him. So what? He didn't see me, and I'm not going to approach him either. He's probably in town for a few days. Mal's extremely devoted to his family, his farm, his country. I knew that when I met him. That man wouldn't move to America, not even for a girl. Especially not for a girl. Definitely not this girl. As for money, he doesn't care for it. Never did. I nibble on a breadstick, down two glasses of wine, and find myself engrossed in a heated conversation, which has taken a turn from beach houses to the best public restrooms in Manhattan. Crate and Barrel on the corner of Houston and Broadway is the lead. When Whitney, Reiner's bitch from hell assistant, sashays over to our table, her hips swinging like a pendulum. Her short, platinum bob is cut with a precision that implies her hairdresser uses a ruler. She is wearing some sort of BDSM gown made of leather stripes that cover her nipples and midriff and not much more. She cocks her head, pouting her scarlet lips. Everyone stops talking because Whitney knows how to keep a secret like I know how to stay away from carbs. Exhibit, breadsticks and wine. Aurora, she purrs, parking a manicured hand on her waist. Everyone calls me Rory, but Whitney calls me Aurora. I made the mistake of expressing my dislike for my name once during a pop star's photo shoot she attended with Reiner. Since then, I've been Aurora to her. If I told her I was allergic to money, she'd immediately wire the company's entire budget into my bank account. There's an idea. Wit? I pop the last piece of breadstick into my mouth, not bothering to meet her eyes. Mr. Reiner would like to have a word with you on the balcony. She glances at me under pinched eyebrows. I swear, Whitney takes orgasmic pleasure in clearing her throat and adding suggestively, alone. Squeezing my shoulder blades together and tilting my chin up, I head toward the VIP area's terrace, knocking back my third glass of wine for liquid courage. Reiner is always 200 pounds of sexual harassment, but especially when he is high and drunk, which he definitely is right now. I tuck the napkin with the hotel logo into the pocket of my dress. Glancing back, I see Whitney sliding into my seat and casing her red-nailed claws on Callum's shoulder, shooting him a sugary smile. Whitney would love nothing more than to prove she's better than me. And she certainly is, if the criteria is best desperate housewives imposter from a plastic suburban neighborhood. The last thing I catch is her whispering something intimate to Callum. He frowns and shakes his head no. Whatever she told him, he seems upset by the suggestion. Walking through the double doors, I find the balcony completely empty. It's colder than my mother's heart in here. I rub my arms, cursing myself for leaving my coat inside, and gate to the railing, admiring the view. Not only is it freezing, but I'm always cold. Ever since I was born, ever since I can remember, I wear sweaters and fluffy jackets everywhere. It's like there's an invisible layer of ice coating my skin at all times. I look up, blinking back at the stars, admiring their beauty, even in this weather. Approaching footsteps clack on the floor behind me. Something heavy falls on my shoulders. A rich wool coat, still warm from body heat. It smells masculine and expensive. Clean earth, pine, smoke, and the type of cologne that's too pricey for mass retail. A shadow looms by my side. He puts a glass of whiskey on the wide marble banister, his elbow next to mine, almost touching but not quite. I twist my head, expecting to see Reiner, and come face to face with Mal. My Mal. It is him, after all. Malachi Doherty. with the lilac eyes, with the hypnotic smile, with the contract I signed on the napkin, with the piece of my heart he never gave back. Only he is not smiling anymore. It doesn't look like he's happy to see me. He said if we ever met again, he'd marry me, no matter what. But that was almost a decade ago, under the influence of alcohol and lust and youth, of possibility. Mal opens his mouth.
Hello, darling.
At his rough Irish accent, my knees buckle, and I find myself grasping the banister. The first flakes of snow fall around us, on my nose, eyelashes, shoulders. A storm is brewing inside my snow globe. 2. 8 years ago, Rory. I prop my back against my father's headstone and pluck a few blades of grass, throwing them in the air and watching as they float down onto my dirty toms. The church bells chime, the sun slinking under green mountains. You could have waited, you know, laid off the alcohol for a month or two so I could meet you, I mumble, yanking out my earbuds. One by U2 still plays distortedly until I kill the music app on my phone and throw it beside me. Sorry, that was rude. I'm cranky when I'm tired, which you probably would have known had you decided to actually meet me. Jesus, Dad, you suck. But even as I say those words, I don't believe them. He didn't suck. He was probably the best. I bang my head against his tombstone and close my eyes. I'm freezing in the middle of summer, as per usual, and exhausted from the long flight from Newark to Dublin, and from arguing with the hostel's receptionist for 45 minutes because my reservation got lost in cyberspace and they ran out of rooms. After I unloaded my small suitcase at a hotel off Temple Bar Square, I took a shower, ate half a bag of stale minibar chips, and freaked out over the bill I was going to pay for my unforeseen accommodations, which no doubt is going to kill my dream of purchasing a new camera before I leave for college. Then my mom called, informing me that I was dead to her for traveling to Ireland in her highly diplomatic way. What is the meaning of all of this? She demanded. First of all, he's dead. Second, you were better off without him. Trust me on that one, sweetie. So you say, Mom. You never gave me a chance to find out myself. He was a lazy drunk and a terrible flirt. He was also talented and funny and sent me gifts every Christmas and birthday. Things that were much more interesting than your Sephora gift cards and eyebrow-enhancing creams, I mumbled. I'm sorry I wanted you to get yourself some nice things. You could have used it to buy better makeup to cover your birthmark. It's easy to be the cool parent when you don't have to do the actual parenting, she huffed. Are you looking for your half-sister? Bet she lives in a fancy schmancy house. All that money ought to have gone somewhere. What she meant by somewhere was probably not to you. I want to look for my half-sister, but I don't know where to start. To be honest, I haven't really planned this trip. I just wanted to see the place where my dad was buried. Expecting, what, some magical connection with the cold stone beneath me? Probably. Not that I would ever admit that aloud. Anything else, Mom? Don't you give me this attitude, young lady. Not when I did my best to raise you, and all he did was drink your inheritance. I grunted. Money, money, money. It's always about the money. I can't believe they buried him near a church, she mused. Hopefully the grass won't grow black like his heart. She hung up after a string of complaints about her two prominent new highlights and milking a promise from me that I'd buy her a carton of duty-free Parliament cigarettes on my return trip. Now here I am, in a cemetery in central Dublin, staring at a gray squirrel who is eyeing the bag of chips peeking from my backpack. I envy its coat of fur. I'd legitimately consider walking around with a sheet of fur all over my body to protect myself from the constant chill. They're not even that good. Who puts vinegar on chips? It's barbaric. I yank the bag out of my backpack, pull a chip out, and throw it its way. The squirrel jumps back in fear, but then gingerly makes its way to the snack. It sniffs the chip, grabs it with its tiny paws, and makes a run up a nearby tree.
"Where I come from, you get jailed for assisting a murderer," a voice cracks behind me.
I look around with a jerk. A priest is standing a few paces behind my father's grave. Black robe, big cross, all ye sinners are doomed expression, the entire shebang. I jump to my feet, grabbing my bag and phone, and swivel to face him. Okay, so he doesn't look super dangerous, but being all alone in a foreign land makes me hyper aware of my vulnerability.
Now.
The man takes slow steps down the rolling green hill on which my father is buried, his hands knotted behind his back. He looks like he lived through both world wars, the Renaissance, and Hannibal's invasion of Italy.
"No need to be scared. I reckon you're highly uninformed regarding the gray squirrels and their hidden agenda."
He stops behind my father's tombstone, gazing at the prominent birthmark on my temple. I hate when people do that, stare so openly, especially because it looks like a scar, a crescent-shaped thing. It is somehow even paler than my normal shade of dead. Mom always encourages me to do something about it. Cover it with makeup, remove it with a laser treatment. Something flickers in his eyes when he sees my birthmark. He has fluffy white hair and a face stained with age. His eyes are so small under heaps of wrinkly skin, I can't even make out their color.
"The gray squirrels endanger the red squirrels, driving them out of their own territory. The reds were here first, but the grays are better at problem solving, street smart. The grays also carry a disease that only affects the red squirrels."
He removes his reading glasses, cleaning them with the hem of his robe. I swallow, shifting my weight from foot to foot. He slides his glasses back on.
"Course, the grays also eat the reds' food and are better at reproducing. Red squirrels don't reproduce under pressure."
I stare at him, not sure if he is an avid environmentalist, an awkward conversationalist, or simply batshit crazy. Why is he talking to me about squirrels? More importantly, why am I listening? Thanks for the info. I play with the hoop in my nose. Leave, Rory. Start walking in the opposite direction before he gives you a lecture about ants.
Just an interesting anecdote about squirrels. And maybe about how unwelcome guests sometimes take over territory simply because they're better than the locals.
He smiles, tilting his head.
And you are...
confused and excessively emotional. Rory, I clear my throat. Rory Jenkins.
You're not from here, Rory.
America. I kick a little stone at my feet, somehow feeling like a punished kid, though I've no good reason to. I'm from New Jersey.
That's why you fed it,
he nods.
Should I take a guess why you're here, or are you in a sharing mood?
I'm too embarrassed to tell him I came here to find closure before I go to college, practically flushing all the money I've saved the past 2 years working at Applebee's down the crap-stained toilet. Neither. I fling my backpack over my shoulder. It's time to go back to the hotel. Nothing is going to come out of this stupid trip. Thanks for the fun facts about squirrels, though. It was totally worth the trip across the ocean. I'd taken my first steps toward the cemetery's gate when I hear his voice behind me.
You're Glenn O'Connell's daughter.
I stop, feeling my shoulders tense. My whole body turns to stone. Slowly, I swivel on my heel, muscles frozen. How do you know?
You're the third offspring to visit his grave. I'd heard the last one was supposed to be American. We've been waiting for you.
We?
Well, I.
Where are the other two? I look around as if they're hiding behind tombstones.
One lives just a short drive from here. Known her since she was a wee baby. Still attends this church with her mammy every Sunday. Glenn was in her life as much as he could be, considering his, limitations.
Translation, alcoholism. Strangely, I still envy her. And the other one?
Lived up north, County Antrim.
Why the past tense?
He passed away a few weeks ago. Leukemia, would you believe? Such a young lad. He met his da a couple times, but never got to know him quite well.
My heart sinks like an anchor, clawing at the bottom of my stomach. I had a brother who died, and now I'll never get to meet him or know him at all. I have a potential family here. This guy, I could have hugged him, comforted him in his last days. I know next to nothing about my father. Only that he died at age 50 of a heart attack that wasn't unwarranted, considering his affection for fast cars, fast women, smoking, drinking, and artery-clogging food. He was born in Tolka, the son of a butcher and a teacher, and shot to fame writing Bells, Bells, a Christmas song that exploded all over the charts in Ireland, the UK, and the US, giving Mariah Carey and George Michael a run for their money. The Christmas song was his first and last brush with labor, or anything similar to a career, but it was enough to secure him a house in Dublin and an annual budget for food and booze. He was a womanizer, the kind to bed everything that moved. He met Mom at a bar in Paris while she was backpacking with friends, and he was trying to find his muse again. They had a one-night stand, and he gave her his address so she could write to him if she ever happened to be in Ireland looking for a good time. When she did write to him, informing him I was in the oven, he invited her to come live with him, but Mom never did. Instead, he sent child support money every month, sent me gifts, letters, but everything was always carefully monitored by my mother. I hated that she controlled our relationship. So I rebelled from a young age. I'd tried to get in touch with him on my own over the years. I wrote him letters my mom wasn't aware of, sent him pictures, emails, poems I'd ripped from books at the library. I begged Mom for crumbs of information about my mysterious sperm donor. I never heard from him, and I thought I knew why. He knew how much of a bossy bitch Mom was, and he was afraid if she found out we were talking behind her back, she'd cut off his communication with me completely. Dad agreed to only talk to me through Mom, and never on the phone out of respect for her. He once wrote to me that he was ashamed of his voice, of what had become of him. He'd said he slurred now, even when he wasn't drunk, and his voice shook all the time. I didn't care what he sounded like. I just needed his voice in my ears. I wanted a dad. Not even a particularly good one. Seriously, any sort of dad would do. My father died 2 months before I graduated high school. I was walking into the kitchen to get a glass of water when Mom got the phone call. I plastered my back to the hallway wall so she couldn't see me. She wasn't sad, or angry, or broken. She just grabbed the vintage corded phone, lit a cigarette, and sat down at the dining table, flipping her hair behind her shoulder.
So he finally kicked the bucket, huh? She coughed. Only sad thing about it is I'll have to tell Rory. She doesn't deserve this heartache.
I didn't know who she was talking to, but I wanted to throw up. He was my father, and he was a part of me. Presumably, a part of me she wasn't too crazy about. if Glenn had waited just a little longer, I could have met him face to face. Now I'm meeting him grave to face, hearing about his legacy of out-of-wedlock offspring from a priest. Class act, Dad. Father, I eye the giant cross on his chest.
Doherty, he provides.
Father Doherty, did he ever say anything about me? In that space of time, between my question and his answer, I feel the entire weight of the world pressing against my shoulders, ready to bury me.
Yes, of course. He spoke of you all the time. You were the apple of his eye. He bragged about your photography. Whenever he got out of the house, he made a point of shoving pictures of you in people's faces and saying, "This right here is my daughter."
Whenever he got out of the house, his situation was so awful. Mom never once tried to help him. Why? How come he never wanted to see me? I don't know why I decide to unload all these questions on this stranger. He couldn't have known my dad too well. It's not like Glenn used to attend church regularly. At least I don't think.
He sent you money every month and loved you from afar, knowing you were better off not knowing him.
Father Doherty evades the painful question.
Some people are weak, but not necessarily bad. He'd been battling depression and alcoholism and wasn't in a state to take care of a child.
Maybe Dad did save me from himself. The important thing is that he talked about me, right? That he took care of me in his own roundabout way. Yeah, I can work with that. But I can't shake the nagging feeling that Mom had a hand in the fact that we never met. A trickle of warmth sneaks into my chest. Can I meet my sister? Do you know where she lives? I'm grasping at straws at this point. I can hear the desperation in my voice, and it makes me actively dislike myself. Get it together. He didn't even leave you a letter before he died.
Ah, poor thing's in a state. I'm afraid she doesn't want to be reached. However, he strokes his chin, mulling an idea. I know someone who could help you. Follow me.
I shadow Father Doherty into the church, all the way to the dim back office, where he sits at a heavy oak desk and scribbles an address on a piece of paper. He talks as he writes.
My grandson busks on Drury Street. He knew your da well enough. Glenn taught him how to play the guitar. I'm sure Mal is full of stories about Glenn. Why don't you talk to him over a few pints, eh? But not too many, unless you want the stories to take unexpected, bizarre turns.
He chuckles, sliding the address across the desk along with a 50-euro note. Thanks, but I can't take your money. I grab the address and shove it into my corduroy jeans pocket, leaving the note untouched.
Why?
Because you owe me nothing. I hitch one shoulder up. And you've already done enough. He looks up, the tenderness in his eyes leaving me with stupid thoughts. Thoughts like, I wish he'd adopt me. I wish he'd be my granddad. There's nothing quite like feeling you don't belong, floating, rootless on this planet without anyone to fight for you. Well, there's Mom, but she has a weird way of showing her love.
Show me unfailing kindness like the Lord's kindness, as long as I live, so that I may not be killed. Samuel, 2014. We all owe each other a little kindness, Rory. A little kindness goes a long way.
His teeth are as yellow as the shards of light cutting through the tall church windows. I swallow, not making a move for the money.
Now go, before my grandson's finished. Malachi rarely stays in one spot. There's always a lady friend or two lurking, and they always drag him into hell knows where, doing God knows what.
I have a pretty good idea as to the what part. Anyway, his Playboy grandson's sex life is not something I want to talk about in a church. Or, you know, ever. How will I know who he is? There must be more than one singer on Drury Street.
Oh, you'll know.
He folds the money between his fingers and hands it to me. I hesitate, but take it. And if I don't, I furrow my brows.
Just yell his name. He'll stop everything at once.
Malachi never could resist a pretty girl or a stiff drink.
I already dislike this Malachi guy. But if he can give me closure, I can ignore the fact that he sounds exactly like my father. A flirt, a drunk, and a man who avoids responsibility like it's the plague. Can I take a few pictures of his grave before I go? He nods, looking at me with sheer pity, the type that crawls under your skin and takes residence, the type that defines you.
You will prevail, Aurora.
Aurora? I never told him my name, only Rory. Aurora? I lift an eyebrow. His smile vanishes and he clears his throat.
Your father told me, remember?
Yes, of course. So why does he look so guilty? Two things hit me in that moment as I regard Father Doherty. One, the man's eyes are mesmerizing, a weird shade of violet dipped in blue that instantly warms you up. Two, I will meet him again someday. Next time I do, he'll change my life forever. I shoulder past the thick wall of female bodies that crescents the street artist. Drury Street is an explosion of colors, scents, and sights. Red exposed brick buildings covered with vibrant graffiti. An Asian market peeking from a corner. A parking garage, a bus stop, and little hipster shops. It looks like a picture, and I can't help but stop everything and make it one. Capturing the beauty of the street with my old camera. A bus passing in a blur, slicing through the colors like the stroke of a brush. Click. Two suited men walking past "Fuck Capitalism" written on a wall. Click. A lone beer bottle lying on the pavement, tucked between junk food wrappers like a sad drunk. Click, click, click. When I finally come face to face with the street artist standing on the side of the pavement, his guitar case open and full of rolled up notes and change, I understand why his grandfather told me I'd recognize him with the self-assurance of an avid believer. I've never seen someone like him before. He is beautiful, true, but that's not what stands out to me. He is radiant. It's like his presence has a presence. He sucks the air out of everything in his vicinity, making it impossible not to look at him. Malachi is tailor-made for a huge, colossal heartbreak. Everything about him, his tattered jeans, filthy boots, white shirt, and leather jacket that was broken in decades ago, screams trouble. He looks like a 70s heartthrob, an icon, a Terry Richardson muse, Bruce Springsteen pre-fame. His voice is like honey and warm spices. It lulls me into a place in my mind I've never been before, even though it's far from beautiful. It is gruff, throaty, and smoky. When someone bumps my shoulder to get closer to him, I snap out of my reverie and realize what I'm listening to. One by U2. The coincidence is strange. I try to tell myself it's nothing. This is Ireland. U2 is a national treasure. His eyes are squeezed shut as he sings. It's like no one exists other than him and his guitar. Something warm rushes through my skin like a heat wave. And I shudder in delight. Warmth. I always thought there was something melancholy about street performers, The way people walk past them, ignoring their music, their art, their passion. But this guy? He's the one doing the ignoring. The tables have turned. He's got the crowd eating from the palm of his hand. Every woman here is under a thick, sweet spell. He's got that Harry Styles quality that makes girls want to bed him, and older women want to adopt him. The men are a cross between impatient, annoyed, and jealous. You can see it in the way they tap their feet, check their watches, nudge their wives and girlfriends to move it. The song ends, and Malachi Doherty cracks his eyes open and stares directly at me like he knew I'd be here, like he watched me watching him through closed eyes. Disoriented, and for some reason wanting to do something, anything, I throw a bill into his guitar case and look away, realizing to my horror that I threw the 50 euros his grandpa gave me. Everyone around me murmurs and whistles. They think it was intentional. I can feel my face flaming red. I bet he thinks I want to sleep with him. Do I? Probably. But should he know that? Hell no. Too late to take the money back now without looking like a crazy person, though. And between crazy and an easy lay, I think I'll go with the latter. Flushed, I back away. Malachi leans forward, grabs my wrist, and tugs at it. Electric heat courses through my veins like a snake bite. I gasp. I'm staring down at my shoes, but he crouches and peeks into my face, a brash, lopsided grin playing on his lips.
"Any requests, Baroness Rothschild of good fortune?" he drawls.
"Can I get my money back? I need to buy you drinks with it so you can tell me about my father." I try to convey to him with what I'm sure is a sweet but seriously psycho look. "None that I can think of." I slant my gaze sideways, playing nonchalant but secretly wanting to die. Bright side, I'm no longer thinking about my dead father. Silver lining and so forth.
"The Copacabana," someone suggests.
"Cavern girl," another shouts.
"Dick in a box."
Malachi looks around and laughs, and the minute his eyes leave my face, the warmth is snatched away. Still, his rolling laughter is like hot wax seeping into my stomach. He straightens up.
"Who's the real Bulgarian who suggested that?"
Some guy in a green beret and orange tweed jacket raises his hand and waves his fingers.
"Not Bulgarian. English."
He grins smugly.
"Jesus, much worse,"
Malachi deadpans, and everyone around us erupts in more laughter. I use the opportunity to gentle my pulse back to normal, smiling along. Ha ha, indeed. Malachi swaggers back to his spot and secures his guitar strap over his shoulder. He has the slender yet muscular body of someone who works in the field, not in the gym. He points the guitar pick at me, and everyone's heads turn to see who he's pointing at.
"I'm not keen on girls who don't know what they want."
He quirks a dark, thick eyebrow.
"But I've a feeling you're here to change that."
He starts playing, and maybe it's because I'm feeling small and vulnerable and broken, but I allow myself to cave to the sound of him, close my eyes and let go. I can tell this one is an original, because I don't know the lyrics. It's too good not to be a hit. He sings it completely differently from the way he did One, like every single word cuts through his flesh, a welt, a scar, a burning thing.
"Weakness, hate, desire. How I'd love to light your soul on fire. In a room full of pretty lost girls and bad broken boys, you will find me, dip me in ice, and drown all the white noise. I want to see the world through your eyes and fall in love. But most of all, I am frightened you don't really exist, Because then my fairy tale has no beauty, just a sad, lonely beast.
This guy can move me without touching me, and touch me without laying a finger on me. His grandfather was right. He's trouble. Everyone is so quiet, I begin to doubt this moment is real. I stop swaying and open my eyes. To my astonishment, I find the entire street staring at him. Even waitresses stand on the thresholds of restaurants and at cafe doors, admiring his voice. And Malachi? He is staring at me. I snag my camera and take a picture of him as he sings. When he finishes the song, he takes a little bow and waits for the claps and shouts to die down. He wiggles his brows at me with a grin that tells me he's going to sleep with me, which is stupid, because I'm 18 and not the sleeping around type. I've only slept with one person in my life, Taylor Kirshner, senior year, because we dated for a while and both of us didn't want to leave for college, saddled with our awkward virginity. But I believe Malachi. We will. I believe him because he is that guy. Someone like my dad must have been. A completely unhinged, typhoon-souled, damaged Romeo who would break your bed, heart, and resolve if you let him. Not maliciously, no. And not because he wants to. He simply cannot help himself. He would wreck everything in his way. This misunderstood, beautiful, brilliant boy who is burdened with gifts he never asked for but unwrapped nonetheless. His talent, charm, and beauty are a weapon, and right now they're aimed at me. I watch as he scoops the money from his guitar case, stuffing it into his pocket. The circle of people around him thins and dies away. Two college-aged girls approach him, tucking their hair behind their ears. He flirts with them shamelessly, shooting me a look every now and again, making sure I'm still standing here. I'm only here because of my father, I want to clarify. I'll tell him that as soon as he's done. Since Malachi feels comfortable keeping me waiting, I don't feel guilty taking out my camera again and snapping a picture of him just as he hoists the guitar case over his shoulder, awarding one of the girls with a kiss to the knuckles.
Flattered, but see, I promised this generous, albeit clingy, lass I'd let her buy me a pint.
I lower my camera and arch an eyebrow at him. He beams at me as both girls scatter along to a bus stop, giggling breathlessly and swatting one another. I think you can afford to buy the generous, albeit clingy, lass a drink, everything considered. I tuck my camera back into my backpack, throwing the hood of my jacket over my head.
Only if she sends me a copy of that picture.
He juts his chin to my backpack, flashing me a lazy grin. Whatever for? He thumbs the strap of his guitar case as he saunters over, stops when we can breathe each other in.
So I'll have her address.
Who's being clingy now? I fold my arms over my chest.
Me.
He grins, the world likely tinted a dramatic shade of mauve through his mesmerizing eyes.
Definitely me. You American?
I nod. He scans me. Purple eyes like his grandfather's, but different somehow. Clearer, with depths that suck you in if you're not careful. I turn around and start walking, knowing he'll follow me. He does.
What's the story?
He shoves his hands into his front pockets. Can we sit somewhere? I ignore his question, looking around us. I could use a drink and something to eat. I'm guessing any normal guy would have 103 questions about what I want from him. But Mal seems nowhere near the normalcy spectrum. He motions with his head in the opposite direction, and we turn around. Now I'm the one doing the following. Turning the tables. This street performer is good at that.
You have a name, he asks.
I catch his footsteps, barely. Aurora?
Aurora. Princess Aurora of...
New Jersey? I roll my eyes. What a flirt.
New Jersey, of course. Known for its processed meat, Goldfinch, and John Bon Jovi. Although I won't hold the latter against you.
That's incredibly considerate.
What can I say? I'm a charitable soul, too. Mind you, everything I know about New Jersey, I learned from a little show called Jersey Shore. Ma'am is a goner for the one who's got enough gel on his hair to fill up a pool.
Polly D, I nod, smiling. Suddenly, I feel hot. I need to get out of my army jacket, maybe even my hoodie, de-onionize, peel off my layers of clothing.
That's the one, he snaps his fingers. Although I'm sure you and your family are nothing like him and his orange mates.
I chew the side of my thumbnail. Actually, my mom is pretty much the queen of those people. She's 25% fake tan, 25% hairspray, and 40% skimpy clothes and hair dye. She is, like, super flammable.
Where's the other 10%?
He chuckles, shooting me a look I can't decode. She's not very good at math, I deadpan. Malachi throws his head back and laughs so boisterously I feel it vibrating in my stomach. Back home, a boy like him would elevate his looks to his own benefit somehow. Become an actor, model, a social media persona, or some other made-up job. My mom would have a heart attack on impact if she ever saw Malachi laugh. He laughs with his entire face, practically inviting wrinkles. Every inch of his flesh is squeezed tight.
I'm Mal, he says.
Since we're mid-walk and he can't shake my hand, he bumps his shoulder against mine, tugging my hoodie down to reveal more of my face. What about you? Are you going to smash any Irish stereotypes? I ask. Mal takes a sharp turn onto a corner street. I follow.
Afraid not,